Welcome back to another edition of Inside Asia. I'm your host, Steve Stein. After COVID-19, one of the biggest subjects occupying academia and boardrooms is conscious capitalism. You're either deeply familiar with the term or you're not. If you're not, climb on board. Capitalism as we know it is about to undergo a major transformation. How can I be so sure? Because for the past 18 months, it's coming up in almost every conversation with CEOs, investors, and thought leaders who say that the old paradigm of operating solely in the interest of shareholders is done and dusted. The new paradigm is more inclusive. That means accommodating and protecting the interests of a broader group of stakeholders, including employees, the environment, and society at large. Governments and regulators have a role to play, but they can't do it alone. Corporations, on the other hand, are better positioned, funded, and geared to drive change, but only if they choose to do so. Cynics say it's already too late. Optimists, like myself, believe that through consensus building, reallocation of resources, and top-down leadership, it is not only possible, but probable. Evidence abounds showing that corporations can be both profit and purpose-driven. In coming weeks, we'll explore the theme of conscious capitalism by speaking to experts across the ecosystem who have a role to play in ensuring a successful shift to a better system. Up this week, the asset management industry. As buyers and sellers of corporate assets, they are the proverbial gatekeepers of corporate financial performance. These are the folks that browbeat CEOs to deliver on quarterly results. Hit the target and share soar. Miss the target and the share price takes a beating. I'm oversimplifying, of course, but you get the point. With $80 trillion under management worldwide, there's power at play. Fortunes have been made and lost on the decisions laid down by asset managers. For the longest time, financial performance has remained the central barometer for all buy and sell decisions. This too must change. Enter a new breed of asset manager. Those that believe that the best corporations are those that do well by doing good. In this week's episode, I speak to one such individual. Muneeb Madni spent 13 and a half years with Morgan Stanley before he saw the light, threw in the towel, and reemerged as CEO of his own asset management firm, Panarchy Partners. In my conversation with Muneeb, we talk about the evolution of the industry, the forces now shaping a new kind of investing, and the emergence of corporations poised to make a difference. I'm here by phone in Singapore. We are still in lockdown, but we're going to have a conversation today about the future of asset management and some of the work you've been doing. Would you mind just giving us a quick introduction? Who are you and what do you do?
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for this opportunity. So yes, my name is Muneeb Madni and I'm a portfolio manager for most of my career, which is about 27 years. And after working with the likes of Morgan Stanley and Aberdeen in 2018, I left traditional asset management to set up what is called Panarchy Partners. And we are pioneers of investing, which is respecting all four forms of capital. And we are here to not necessarily disrupt the asset management industry, but definitely try to be thought leaders in the new way of investing. And that's the best way I would like myself and the Panarchy team to be remembered for.
Well, let's start with that, asset management. My understanding is there's something in the range of $80 trillion under management worldwide. Is that your understanding?
Yeah. I mean, the power of asset management is incredible. I remember in the 1980s, the total value of financial assets globally was about one times GDP. On last account in 2017, Morgan Stanley had a number, it was 3.5 times global GDP. So you're right, the numbers move around given how the markets have been moving around more recently, but it is an incredible number and way above and beyond the normal GDP of the world at this point in time.
Why is that? What's happened in the last 15, 20 years to raise or grow the number to that degree?
Yeah, I have a few things, but the most obvious is that the valuation of financial assets has just exploded. And what I mean by that, one of the things that drives valuation of most financial assets is what is called the long bond yield or the discount rate. And we've had an amazing bull run in interest rates. I remember when I was a child, the 1980s in Australia, bond yields were at 14, 15%. And now we are talking about bond yields or bond interest rates at -0 and minus for most developed markets. So as that market has moved, the bond yields have moved. Asset valuations globally for most financial assets have just gone through the roof. And that's why the number has become credible.
Is this a case of too much money chasing too few deals and too few opportunities?
Definitely. And I think that's part of the problem that has evolved for the asset management industry is that, one, there's a lot of money, which was building anyway in the last couple of decades. But more recently, since the global financial crisis, we had terms such as QE and various other forms of financial impetus given by the central banks globally. And they just further given a tsunami of liquidity. And all of this money is just aimed at fewer and fewer assets, creating bubbles in different segments.
It feels like the world of asset management is going through some changes. In the industry, is it going through a bit of soul searching in this moment? And if so, why?
Yeah, I mean, the asset management industry, as you and I know it now, is only maybe 50, if not 60 years old. So it's not that old, but it has evolved over these times, over these decades for sure. And I think now, after about 50, 60 years, it is hit this point where there's a few things disrupting or making it do this soul searching. And we can go into details for sure later. But yes, there's no doubt that the asset management industry is at a very precarious point where it can hopefully change for the better, or it can actually be somewhat destructive for itself.
You know, I think everyone's trying to version itself. So you get the feeling that there are industry funds, there are sector funds, country funds, trend funds. I mean, you've got index funds. Yeah. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And now the latest and greatest appears to be something which we're going to talk about with this ESG-related investing. Can you tell us what ESG is and why this is an up-and-coming trend?
Sure. So ESG is actually an acronym for environment, social, and governance. And it is basically an evolution of what people might have heard before, CSR, which is corporate social responsibilities in the 1980s, 90s. And then it evolved into what was called social responsible investing. And ESG is an evolution of that, where the onus of proof is on the corporations, and the people asking for proof are the investors to show that companies that they're investing in, that those companies are actually respecting environment, society, and have solid governance. So this is just, you could say, an evolved version of a bit more focused towards stakeholders.
Yeah, I remember as a journalist writing about green funds in the mid-1990s. It didn't last long, green funds, that is. What went wrong, and then why is it different now?
Yeah, I think a lot of things have evolved since then. In the 1990s, we had only just started with the Rio Declaration in 1992, and the whole environment and the impact of environment was almost seen as an activist playground. It wasn't seen as a bit more pervasive, a bit more accepting globally. I think fast forward to now, and you do find that environmental challenges with climate change, with plastic, with water limitations, waste disposal, all these issues now are common knowledge for even children. And I think that's where it is definitely a lot more topical, a lot more up in people's minds. And also now a lot of standardization has improved when it comes to environmental metrics. And I think that's helping what is now the E part of ESG when people are investing.
What's driving this? Is this coming from corporations just advocating to do things differently and do things better, being more mindful of their broader stakeholder communities? Is it Wall Street that's contemplating and thinking, well, this is a new opportunity to drive investment interest among millennials? Or are there really truly economic pressures in play which require us to shift the way we make investments and think about investments?
Yeah, I think that there is no one single, you could say, catalyst for this. The pressure is coming from various angles. The way I look at it is that up until now, corporations have for centuries outsourced externalities, whether it be externalities around environment or human capital or social capital. And they've outsourced it to the environment itself or to governments and society. But more recently, at least this century, we have seen a lot of the stakeholders around environment and human social capital have been pushing back and requiring a lot more respect and, you know, better treatment of these as assets. And this can be coming in the form of litigation some places, or it's coming in the form of legislation. It's coming in the form of social pressure. And even corporates themselves are often finding that doing things right by the environment, by the society, is good business, you know, in terms of revenue, better revenues, with better products, whether it be touching the millennials or even the parents of the millennials. So I think there's various ways this is playing out, and the pressure is building for better stakeholder engagement and respect.
So who sets the terms, Munib? Who's the one who's saying, who's behind that $80 trillion in assets under management? And what's their interest in changing the criteria?
Yeah, sadly, it's not necessarily the asset owners and managers. I'll be honest with you there. I think that asset owners and asset managers, and even, you know, the boards of asset owners, they all have agency dilemma. They have job security issues. And therefore, asset management industry, one of its weaknesses is that it is backward looking and not visionary enough. They believe they're trusting without caring in some ways. They want to see financial returns because that's what they are judged on. So the movers and the shakers in this space, the asset owners and managers, I think they're almost complying because they have to. The real leaders in this are actually corporations, which is positive, which is very encouraging. I mean, given the fact that if you look at big companies like the Apples, and I'm not saying whether these guys are good or bad, but I'm just saying corporations, the mega corporations, the mega multinationals, they are now more powerful than many emerging markets by themselves. So when corporations start moving in the right direction and incorporating some of these things themselves, I think that is putting a lot more pressure on asset owners and even asset managers like myself to actually see what they are doing on the ground and whether or not it makes sense for investors. So that is the sad reality of it. And I think there's a bit of legality behind that as well, which is that legally, up until now, shareholder primacy is still the rule of law, whether it be in common law or legislated or stakeholder capitalism is not here yet, but increasingly even lawyers and judges and courts around the world are moving in that direction to help further fasten or hasten this process.
So pension funds, employee saving schemes, anybody who puts money into the markets and into the hands of asset managers is expecting a different type of investment criteria or investment approach?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you, again, going back to the history of asset management for the last 40 years, and this is courtesy of, I would say, Nobel Economic Prize winners, that from the 1950s, when Harry Markowitz first came up with the efficient frontier, portfolio frontier, and CAPM and the various other risk return metrics, asset industry and asset management industry is beholden to what they call risk and return. And this is risk and return only on financial assets. So for most asset owners and for most asset managers, they are measured on risk return around financial capital. Nowhere do they put in place other stakeholders and progress on maybe human, social, environmental capital. And that is the rigidity that, and one of the dilemmas that asset management industry faces, is that how do you give up a standard which is limited to risk and return and excludes progress for the rest of the stakeholders, including the environment? And I think that is where we have to see the biggest impetus will come when there is regulations that allow explicitly for stakeholders to be treated equally as shareholders.
You know, Munib, in the absence of a universal view on what it is to account and track sustainability and ESG as it's defined, how do companies show up for this? How are they seen by investors or asset managers like yourself in terms of being worthy of the investment at an ESG level? I still get the feeling that companies are resisting the idea of making these fundamental changes. They talk a good game, they talk sustainability, they may have a corporate social responsibility program, but it doesn't really drive through the organization at a fundamental level and therefore justify it being categorized as an ESG worthy investment. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, the definition of sustainability is a very subjective one. So waiting for a global standard to appear on that, good luck. That's not going to happen. What will happen is that there's going to be gradations of, let's say, sustainability, resilience, even impact that investors are going to have to become comfortable with when they are making their investment decisions. That's the first point. The second, to do with actually incorporating and corporations incorporating sustainability genuinely internally, that actually has to be driven from the top. That has to be driven from the leadership, and that has to be driven from the board. And if it's a company with which is dominated by a founder, like we have plenty of them in the tech space currently, it has to be driven by them. Without them, you are not going to see the sustainability or respect for human, social, environmental capital become part of a firm's DNA. And you do find that globally, there are plenty of companies, and some of these are very old, by the way. I mean, as an example, you look at the Tatas in India. I mean, they have majority of the Tata share ownership is owned by the Tata Trust, you know, and that whole idea of a corporation for the benefits of the broader community. Tata is a 150-year-old company. So having leadership from the top percolating these concepts all the way down to the bottom has been happening for a long time, and I think will continue to happen, but it has to come from the top. Cannot be. That's the other thing about sustainability. It has to become part of a corporation's DNA, as opposed to just for the sake of winning some award or being on some FTSE for good or some sustainability gold medal 3-star winner. So I think people who look at companies in a bit more detail and go through engagement, deal with them, and can work out the ones that are greenwashing or rainbow washing, as it is called, as opposed to the guys who've actually properly incorporated that into their business models.
Well, that's where it is. The cynicism comes there, because both with the financial industry and wondering whether or not this is just another gimmick, you know, another way of selling, assets, or is it just a fundamental shift that's occurred that you and others have gotten onto and therefore are now looking for viable and reasonable investments, and that's when, you know, we have to talk about the companies a little more. If you look at the number of ESG related funds under management, it's about 10% of the total, or around $8 trillion, is what I've seen. Is that about right from your understanding?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are changing on a daily basis, especially as many of traditional strategies are rebranding themselves as ESG. So I'd take it with a pinch of salt, you know, just because someone is rebranded their product doesn't necessarily mean they've gone and done their homework. So yes, it's a number that's increasing. It sounds impressive. I would say maybe a tenth of that, if not even less, is actually truly following a strict ESG regime.
Well, there it is. And that's why I'm wondering, what's your approach? I mean, what is your bullshit monitor on this? How do you determine whether or not a company is really acting and engaging as an ESG compliant organization versus just, as you say, greenwashing or presenting itself one way or another? What is the method you use? Are there certain standards or indexes, or have you created your own?
Rather than relying on SAP or Moody's and various other rating agencies, we go directly to a company to see, have they done a proper, genuine stakeholder engagement over time? By doing that, they should be able to identify material issues that are relevant not only to their shareholders, but to their other stakeholders, their employees, their suppliers, their customers, the society they work in, their environment that they operate in. And once these companies have identified those material issues, it also allows them to not only respect those issues, but create purpose within the firm. With that in mind, they should be able to give us what we call smart targets around these other forms of capital, which is specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time sensitive. We will not invest in a company that has not done a stakeholder engagement, that has not identified material issues relating to non-financial capital as well, and that has not put in place targets and is not delivering on those targets. So for us, that is the way we, at this point in time, until we can find a lot more credible, reliable, measurable data from various other external sources, we need to engage with companies to see what sustainability journey they are tracking and whether or not they're delivering on us. And that becomes the basis for us.
So it sounds like you're prepared to offer corporations a lot of latitude here, as long as they're demonstrating effort, good intentions, stakeholder engagement of some sort. It's a starting point. And it sounds like a starting point for you is good as long as they can demonstrate some progress, albeit it could be very different from company B, C, or D.
Yeah, so true. For us, it is, we're not waiting to find that perfect company. Unfortunately, there's no such thing as a perfect company when it comes to all four forms of capital. There isn't. But what we do want is we want to find companies that are moving towards equal respect for all forms of capital. And in most cases, when we do this analysis, it's not a one point in time analysis. It's a multi-year, if not multi-decade analysis that we have done on these companies. As an example, Unilever, for example, started its first stakeholder engagement in 2000. So we've had 20 years of following their progress on how they identify material issues and how they deliver on those material targets they've put in place for a company like Unilever. So we do have enough companies out there that have a longer period of progressive improvement in their targeting and delivery. And it is the incremental or the rate of change at the margin that matters the most, rather than some absolute level of achievement which a company needs to achieve. Yeah. As long as they're showing us improvement, we want to help them improve that at a faster rate.
It just comes back to, and not to beat this one too hard, but this indexing or rating idea. I mean, creditworthiness, for instance, is an important calibrator when you're trying to determine whether or not an investment is a good idea or not. Is it not possible, or is it simply too early, to create a set of criteria that is acceptable, largely acceptable, by most of the asset management community so that we can begin to compare apples to apples?
I think it's a bit too early. And the reason I say that if you look at the four forms of capital, financial, environmental, social, and human capital, financial capital has had more than 60 years of standardization of financial results. Do you know that the first company that ever put a balance sheet and income statement together, it was in 1903, and it was US Steel. They were the first company to do a financial statement analysis, a financial statement disclosure. And guess what? When was the first time we found the globalized standard of what is now accounting standards, like the AASB?
No idea.
It was 1973. So it took us 70 years to wait for the world to come to some conclusion around what should be a globalized standard for financial statements. Now, in the same vein, we are going to take some time for environmental balance sheets or income statements to become globally standardized. Now, that does not mean that we should not be looking at them now, or we should wait for that to happen. Not at all. Now, until that standardization happens, relying on an external ranking or weighting system for asset managers leaves them in the dilemma of how will they evolve themselves as and when those metrics change. And I'll give you an example of a metric changing on the environmental side. I don't know if you've heard of SBTI.
Yes, please tell us about that.
Yes, so that is science-based targeting initiative. And this SBTI is all around how will corporations who in the past have been very aggressive in putting in environmental or GHG emission or various climate change targets, how will they be targeting or getting targets that are credible and in line with the IPCC that came out of the Paris Climate Change Accord, requiring 1.5 degrees or less increase in temperature by 2030. Now, the SBTI is only a few years old, and 50% of the portfolio companies we have either got SBTI approved emission targets, or they are headed towards that in the next 2 years and are getting validated, their targets are getting validated. Now, 5 years ago, that wasn't even in existence. So we are, even within 5 years, we have seen this new standard appear out of nowhere to help corporations put in place targets that are now being accepted globally. In the next 5 years, we're going to have similar targeting and similar standardization on social capital, on human capital. So from that perspective, people like myself who have the luxury of having sustainability specialists working for us internally and engaging with the companies that we invest in, we can wait for those to happen. For now, we will stick with our own analysis that standardization will take some time. And for the bigger legacy asset owners, they will have to evolve over time. And that is where I suppose the risk lies for them and the opportunity lies for us.
So in the absence of a gold standard, let's talk a little bit about some of the companies you look for and why.
Yeah. So as I said, to us, first and foremost, we start with this view that any company that is incorporating sustainability or ESG or PanVesting, whatever you want to call it, into their business models, and it is driven by the top, which is the governance, the CEO, the C-suite, even for example, the board of directors, that is crucial to us. And some of the companies that the European companies tend to do very well in that space, the consumers, multinationals, generally do very well because from the late 1990s to the early 2000s, consumer advocacy had forced them into becoming a lot more stakeholder engaged and a lot more stakeholder respectful. So in our portfolio, you will find companies such as Danone, Reckitt Benckiser, Unilever. I mean, they are, you could say, the poster childs of targets, putting in place targets around human, social, environmental capital. As an example, if you look at Danone, they led the way in terms of environmental packaging targets, saying that by 2025 they will have 100% of their packaging either recyclable, compostable, or reusable. Then if you go towards someone like Reckitt Benckiser on social capital, they have committed 1% of their profit before tax to be given for social investment opportunities for their stakeholders beyond their shareholders. In the same vein, if you look at someone like SAP, which is a German software company, they have also got very high, strong targets around their GHG emissions and wanting to be carbon neutral by 2025. So the list goes on. I mean, for us, the point is that we want companies, depending on their circumstances, depending on the industry they're in, and depending on their stakeholders and their stakeholders' concerns, to identify their own targets that matter to them and where they can actually truly make an impact, rather than for the sake of just getting a AAA rating on S&P or a Moody's sort of sustainability, and therefore promise things that don't even make sense to them. That's not what we want. And that's where I think we distinguish ourselves, is that we want our companies to put in smart targets, not targets for the sake of getting onto some sustainability index.
So Muneeb, by nature of the types of changes these companies are trying to make, they are long-term and evolving. Therefore, doesn't it suggest that your investments need to be long-term? You need to stick by them through the highs and the lows, or not? What would it take for you to divest from one of these organizations that you originally thought might be on the right track?
Sure. And you hit the nail on the head there, Steve. One of the biggest problems and challenges that the asset management industry faces currently is this whole short-termism. And there is this massive disconnect between expectations of delivery of progress on non-financial capital, and the time horizons for that, and versus the short-term return only, financial return only focus that the asset management industry has become. When I started my career in the 1990s, the average, you could say, holding of a company in a portfolio used to be 2 to 3 years. Now, on some numbers, it's less than 6 months. You know, so people's focus, investors' focus on the financial return has become very short-term. And that is where I think the industry does need to change and need to move towards a longer time horizon for their investments. And the second question, sorry, can you just repeat the second?
Yeah, it's just what would it take for you to divest from an organization that you originally thought might be worthy?
Sure. So obviously, being PAN investors, we want our companies to show respect for all forms of capital. And that is not only financial. So if there is some degradation in their financial thesis, they will obviously leave our portfolio. Or if their financial value and their financial capital is extinguished, that will leave our portfolio. But we in our portfolio have actually exited a company that will, I can mention it. It was J&J. And J&J, when we bought J&J, we bought it with eyes wide open that this is a company that has a great history of delivering for shareholders and stakeholders. It has a 70-year-old manifesto around stakeholders, which is called the Credo. It's a detailed view of what matters to J&J. And we were of the opinion that even with some of the issues that are lingering around the talcum powder issue with J&J, and even as some of the other issues that they have, they will, especially around the opioids issue, as you know, in America, that J&J will take leadership in finding a global solution, given they are a big part of the industry. Now, we exited J&J when we saw that instead of taking a leadership role, global leadership role in finding a fair solution for everyone involved, they had started taking a bit more litigious approach on a case-by-case basis. We knew that this was going to be a stakeholder degrading and also shareholder impacting event for the next couple of years. And even though there was no financial immediate impact, just the approach was that they were taking was not in line with our expectations around the other forms of capital. And we exited that position. So we are very cognizant of companies and what they do when the times are tough, and how they treat their non-financial stakeholders as well.
You know, I'm smiling because I'm fascinated to hear you talk about looking at an organization and either investing or exiting based on their behaviors. I mean, for so long, investors could care less as long as an organization was making money, as long as they didn't break any laws, even if they were exploitative in some ways, that was okay if the returns kept coming in. What has shifted for you specifically? Why have you decided, if the whole game is about maximizing profits and taking your returns, what's compelling you and others to go into this business?
We think that the only way shareholders can even sustain their financial returns is if all stakeholders are taken care of and if all other forms of capital are treated like assets. And once you have that mindset, when you start, even as an investor, start thinking of all forms of capital as being assets that require commensurate returns and progress on them, then this decision-making becomes very easy. For most people, they are still stuck in financial returns versus progress on all other forms of capital. We have taken that, you could say, maybe leap of faith or that belief that no, if J&J or any other company does anything to the detriment of their stakeholders now, even shareholders will suffer ultimately later on. And that too, once you have that approach, then it doesn't necessarily become almost like we are trying to be some kind of morality police or anything like that. No, it almost becomes part of the you know, the investment or pan-investment philosophy. And that to me is why it's, I find it not that difficult a decision to make.
Well, you know, it's really interesting to hear you talk about this, because if you think about the concentric circles of organizations and individuals that have a vested interest in this transformation, think about the pension groups that are saying, we now want, well, we're only going to give you our money if you basically are ESG compliant. Then you think about the companies who are saying, you know what, I know that there's enough information out there to say that I can protect the interests of my stakeholders and not my just my shareholders. I can be purpose-driven and not just profit-driven. And then you have asset managers like yourself who are saying, you know what, there is something to be said for this. It's good business to be thoughtful and engaging and protecting the environment and looking at these things as assets and not just liabilities or risks. So if all of that is happening, and there's of course investors and millennials and others are saying, I only want to put my limited savings into assets that actually are going to be investing in the right organizations for the right reasons, it seems to me the only aspect in the way is Wall Street. And if Wall Street is continue to say that it is return at all cost, we can't break the back of this thing is the feeling I have. What do you think about that?
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, it's easy to blame Wall Street for a lot of things. And, you know, they deserve a lot of the criticism that Wall Street gets, no doubt. But I do think that if we take just Wall Street aside, this whole transition that we are seeing towards, again, sustainable stakeholder capitalism, ESG, again, however you want to term it, there's no one person that can either make it happen or one entity that can actually prevent it from happening. So let's be clear on that. This genie is out of the bottle now, or this cat's out of the bag. We are headed in that direction. And the way I like to sort of equate it, it's no different from us all knowing that electric vehicles are good for the environment. But guess what? Most people are still waiting to see new vehicles, greater options in the vehicles. So it's not just BYD and Tesla, some more options out there. People are looking for increased infrastructure so that, okay, by the way, I can actually go and plug in my vehicle and not be stranded. People are looking for even regulations and maybe incentives, tax incentives. And even people are wanting to see measurement tools around that. Am I really actually saving the earth by doing all of this? And when all of those things happen, people get enough confidence. And that is what is going to take some time for all of this move to eventuate. I'm an optimist. I do think in 20 years' time, this whole idea of ESG, like this whole distinction between sustainable versus unsustainable assets, will not be there. You will find this transition from what I call shareholder primacy-driven corporations, which has been in place for almost 100 years, I think over the next 30, 40 years is going to evolve to a broader stakeholder capitalism approach to corporations. And I think, sadly, events like COVID is only going to be accelerating this change. So I think Wall Street will come on board kicking and screaming, and they are. Wall Street, no doubt, is going to have to accept the reality that corporations will have less, will have to invest some of that financial returns that they wanted in their own pockets. And that is going to be actually to the benefit of everyone. And these things will happen over time. And Wall Street is moving. There is no doubt Wall Street is moving.
Well, you've raised COVID, and let's talk about this. To what degree will this pandemic, this crisis, and the economic sabotage that it's created negatively impact corporations' movement towards more of a purpose-driven or ESG-compliant agenda?
I think it's the opposite. I think it's actually, pushed forward this whole move towards a stakeholder approach, and it is so obvious. Like 10 years ago, when the GFC happened, global financial crisis happened, or even before that, when we ever had crisis, how many corporations were actually upfront? And this is not only, by the way, US where corporations that are being given trillions of dollars by various forms of packages. Outside of that, globally, there are companies that are keeping on board their staff as long as they can, providing increase health insurance, providing various other forms of support, protecting their the suppliers and their distribution supply chain, and making sure they survive this crisis. You know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, this would not happen. Now it is very clear that there are many corporations globally that are actually taking this step, knowing very well that their stakeholders need to be taken care of. Otherwise, they as a company will not survive COVID. And I think this COVID is actually just fast-tracking, and it's actually showing which companies do care about their stakeholders. That's why we've seen a lot of buybacks, dividend cuts, because people are deploying that cash flow for their stakeholders.
Turning our attention to this part of the world, how do Asia corporations stack up when it comes to this ESG agenda?
Yeah, so within our organization, sadly, the Asian companies don't make a big proportion of our corporations for our resilience framework. And the reason for that is that we have very high standards around board independence, which sadly a lot of Asian corporations do not pass. It doesn't mean that these corporations don't have a history of doing a lot of good, whether through their CSR, and even maybe now evolved into other forms of sustainability efforts for sure. So I think Asian corporations, Asian regulators, such as the various forms of stock exchanges, are also moving in the direction of incorporating, non-sustainability or non-financial capital metrics into their disclosures, into various other forms of measurement as well. It is maybe at a slower pace, but it is happening.
Well, why would that be? Is there just not the same pressures being placed on organizations from the pensions or from the investors? Or is it that they're just still viewed as developing or emerging and therefore not mature in some regard?
I think there's a couple of elements to why the adoption is a bit slower. One, I keep in mind that Asian corporations, especially the listed space, they are still very young, relatively speaking, compared to maybe the European peers or even their American peers. So, being listed entities and being accountable to minority shareholders, let alone stakeholders.
So I let's be a little hard on those Asia corporations for a minute. I would say that, why should youth be an excuse? Yeah. Just because you're younger or haven't been listed as long? And frankly, if I think of the family-run component, I think, well, that gives you the kind of the management and leadership time in order to make the changes required to be ESG compliant, and you're not subject to the type of rollover or churn that you see in the CEO echelons in the US and Europe, where you might get 2 or 3 years if you're lucky, and then you're out. This seems to me to be a perfect environment for starting to drive some of these agendas. Should governments get involved? Should they insist upon it? Should there be listing requirements, do you think, to urge it along?
Yeah. No, listen, you raise a very good point that while I've highlighted some of the reasons why they haven't been at the tipping end or the front end of this whole move, there are also many reasons why they can, do what they have done successfully in the past and leapfrog some of the basic hurdles if they want to. And, as an example, if you look at Asian companies, they have a longer runway in terms of top line growth and revenue growth, given the demographics, given the growth profiles in most Asian countries. So even if they wanted to start investing and deploying some of that top line growth into sustainability models and still maintain fairly good profitability, they can. So you're right. These guys can do a lot and a lot faster than most other places. Because if you look at a lot of the moves that are being made by developed corporations and multinationals globally, these are companies like, again, if I go back to the Unilevers or the Danones and SAPs of the world, they're already leaders, global leaders with efficiency and productivity at most probably global standards. So for them to incorporate some of these non-financial capitals has been a hard thing to do. When you look at some of the regional leaders or country leaders in Asia, they are still coming up that productivity, efficiency grade, you could say. And therefore, it allows for them to incorporate it now faster, quicker, and cheaper, some of these things. So yes, there is definitely a lot more leeway for them to do it. But again, it comes to leadership. And leadership, whether it be the corporation CEO, the board, the founder, or whether it be even regulations, you know, rules and regulations in most of these countries are still catching up, you know. And having said that, they're not far behind what I saw in or what I see in the US when it comes to disclosures, whether it be at the SGX or whether it be at Bursa Malaysia. You know, some of the disclosure that they are requiring their companies to do is definitely a step in the right direction. It can be made a bit more granular for sure.
Muneeb, a great moment in asset management history. I hope it continues on this path, and we thank you for taking time out to speak with us.
No, Steve, thank you so much, and it was a pleasure, and would love to chat about this and any other topic within the asset management space, that is.
That was my conversation with Muneeb Madni, Senior Global Asset Manager and Founder and CEO of Panarchy Partners. All big change begins with small grassroots movements, and this discernible shift in the world of asset management is no exception. Whether Muneeb and others like him can sustain the momentum and demonstrate to investors that their strategies can and will generate returns is the real question. Our conversation revealed a few key themes, and it begins with the will of the corporate to knuckle down and make some institutional changes. If you consider the many and varied environmental, social, and governance issues that underpin and guide corporate behavior, then tackling and reforming just one is as good a place as any to get things started. Muneeb refers to such initiatives as stakeholder engagements. He and his organization look for companies that take the initiative. The results are important, but the effort counts as well. Sometimes making big changes takes time, and that's where publicly listed MNCs might be at a disadvantage. CEO and leadership tenure is essential. Driving end-to-end sustainability goals requires coordination and commitment. That's a concern when you consider that last year saw a record number of CEO departures from Fortune 500 companies. Economic uncertainty, political instability, and rising shareholder demands make for a mean broth. Like they say, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. It seems that only founder CEOs like Elon Musk or long-tenured and financially successful CEOs like MasterCard's Ajay Banga receive the necessary investor leeway to drive important and sustainable changes. That raises two key points. First, what would it take to reframe the way listed companies are rewarded for investing in their broader stakeholder communities? And second, doesn't this play to the strengths of Asian companies, where to a large degree the CEOs are the owners, or at least majority shareholders of their organizations? To the first point, there's both the questions of standards or ratings that are universally accepted and also the will to pick stocks that offer something more than financial returns. Standards, for one, are in their infancy. Dozens of ESG-focused rating agencies have sprung up in recent years, and while there's overlap, there's no universal agreement on which ones are best. Then there's that thorny question of investors. That's a whole nother can of worms. Convincing the average asset manager to think about something more than financial return is like getting a shark to turn vegetarian. It's possible, but in the absence of explicit investor directive to back ESG-only holdings, it's not likely. And what about Asian companies? What's their excuse? Why on the whole do they rank so poorly when it comes to promoting broader stakeholder interests? I'd argue now, as I've argued before, that this is Asia's time. Companies in this part of the world have demonstrated extraordinary resilience, innovation, and ability to build brand loyalty. Why not show companies in US and Europe that they can lead a purpose-led agenda? However you look at it, conscious capitalism is a team sport. There's an ecosystem necessary to support the very difficult decisions that corporations are required to make. Financial incentives served as a great motivator for the past 60 years, but with a global system in distress, the environment at risk, and employees racked with job insecurity, maybe it's time for a new class of whips and carrots. That's it for this week's episode of Inside Asia. There's more where this came from. If you have concerns about the future of capitalism and the role of the corporation, let us know. Reach out on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Twitter, leave a message, or start a conversation. In the meantime, if you're not a regular listener, please subscribe to Inside Asia wherever you download and listen to podcasts. There are over 130 episodes to choose from. We cover everything from geopolitics to emerging trends. If you're doing business in Asia, listen to what Inside Asia's guests have to say. You won't find a better business-focused podcast in Asia on Asia. As always, we thank you for listening. And until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.